I will start by introducing David Krüger, and we are very honored to have him as a speaker at our chapter, at our ICF chapter. And I looked at your bio, and it's really impressive. I think you have written 17 books, and you have a lot of profound experience with coaching in this area. And it also seems like you have been listed in America's Psychiatrist, and that's very impressive as well. So we are honored, and I'm pleased to have you as a guest. And I also really like the questions you put forward to our members. And those were good questions, and also believe that the answers are quite interesting as well. So that would be exciting if we also have time to elaborate a bit on that on them. So thank you, and welcome to all the participants who are already online.
Thank you very much. It's a privilege to be invited to present to you. Let me request that those of you who have an open line that you manage the sound, mute *6 until you're ready to speak or ask a question, and it will preserve our focus and the purity of the sound. I have really fond memories of speaking to this group at a live seminar several years ago. I have a huge connection to Colorado. CTA, where I'm dean of curriculum, is located in Boulder, and to Denver, where I did my psychiatry residency a few years ago. And I come back every year to ski and steamboat. So if you want to invite me in person to do anything, be sure it's in March. I really appreciate the responses from some of you to the two questions. I value that input, and I'm going to incorporate the responses into what I say. And I mentioned before the introduction, this seminar is being recorded. My IT guy will send the link to me, and I'll send it on to post for online playback and MP3 recording. So thanks again for the responses to the questions. Before we start, are there any other responses to those questions? To if we were to sit down face-to-face, what would you most like to ask me about this topic? And if you walked away saying this is one of the best seminars ever, what would it be? Other responses right now before we move into the topic of states of mind in strategic coaching. Any other responses to that? One at a time now. Any input about that? Okay, well, I'll move directly into our topic, and I want to preserve some time at the end for discussion, and I will try to incorporate the questions that I already have into that discussion. I'm going to put us on lecture mode. There's a lot of material I want to present, and I hope it's not too much or too compressed. Then we'll save some time at the end for discussion, and I welcome your questions and your responses and things that we might talk about at the end of the hour, and I definitely will save some time for that. I want to discuss what I think is the most important variable to determine success for your clients, the mastery of regulating states of mind. I want to present a couple of case vignettes to illustrate a scientific and, I believe, very effective system of mind, brain, and behavior change that lasts. So first, and you have as downloadable, and hope you've printed it out, the outline. It's kind of an annotated outline of what I'll talk about, as well as a neural conditioning chart, and I'll help you make sense of that in a moment. To first understand states of mind, a state of mind is a mind-body state. It's like a specific software program that determines how we perceive and process information and then how we respond. A state of mind is a set of particular emotions, memories, mental models, and behavior patterns. A key element of mentor coaching is helping a client become aware of various states of mind with a particular focus on which state works best for what purpose. Clients may move from a state in which they feel stuck or myopic to one of possibilities, to a state where the scope and range of thinking and possibilities is much broader. We're going to talk about how to do that in just a moment. But first, an illustration of how states of mind actually can be seen in a very simple way. And this is kind of an extreme example, but it'll give you an idea. If you take a rat and put it in a maze, you can teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, if before you take the rat to teach it to get to the cheese, you inject it with just a little bit of amphetamine, you alter its state to a little bit of a stress-like response, a little bit of anxiety. You teach it to get to the cheese, and it can go again and again. Now, you take away the amphetamine, and the rat can't get to the cheese. It can literally, in that maze, die of starvation, even though it has in a part of its brain the information about how to get there, but it can't access it. Reinject the amphetamine, it immediately goes to the cheese. State-specific learning and state-dependent memory. Now, this is an example of how two distinct states of mind occur without overlap. It's really an example of extreme stress, kind of like post-traumatic stress disorder, when an entire event may not be remembered the usual way, or maybe multiple personality disorder, where distinct states exist without a seamless blending of moving from one state to another, where we usually experience this as a kind of seamless process in our ordinary lives. A more common example is we try to think of someone's name and can't. We know it's on the tip of our tongue, but we just can't recall it. Then later, in a more relaxed name, we're not trying to think about the name, immediately pops out. So each of us has a range of states with some awareness of what state works best for what endeavor, even of how to enter and exit different states. It's important to become aware of which state to enter for a creative endeavor, like creative writing, and which state to enter for a different process, like editing. What state of attention and concentration works best for everything from the alertness of business endeavors to relaxation for sleep. So we have a whole range of different states of mind. So let me start with a case vignette. It'll give you an example. And look at the neural conditioning chart that you had, the single page that was downloaded, because I'm going to use that. And I developed this in part to work with this guy. Jim was the COO, Chief Operating Officer of a large healthcare company in a major U.S. city when we first started working together. As a result of our work for a few months, he decided to toss his hat in the ring for a CEO position. He had some great offers. We crafted a terrific compensation package. And fairly soon, as he took this new position, Jim and another company CEO, and I'll call him Tom, were negotiating a joint venture. This was something that was already underway before Jim joined. Jim said, look, I'm more myself than I've ever been. I'm way beyond what I've imagined. But this one, I can't get my arms around. When Tom gets on his soapbox and explains simple things to me, like he would to a novice, I overreact. I want to tell him off. It feels like a put down. And I said, I understand it bruises your pride when you take it personally. He said, yeah, I've got to think and not react, but I get sucked in even when I know what not to do. He just sets me off the way he talks down to me, like he knows it all. It's like I can't not respond. Jim recognized this reactive model and that he needed a strategy, that he departed a state of mind where he could reason and negotiate strategically. And I asked him, as preparation for this, what ideally would you like to do? He said, well, I have to think and not react. I have to let him finish his points and get the emotion out of it for me, but I haven't been able to. He was saying, in effect, that he needed to regulate his state of mind and manage his emotions in order to be effective. Now, when someone's in an emotional state, they're marooned in their right brain, the feeling intuitive brain. The emotional brain can hitchhike on any kind of usual balance and hijack the intellectual logical brain and hold it hostage. So what do? Your brain is working against you. We then collaborated on a strategy to use his emotion as a signal to plan action steps rather than react. So what we did, and look at the chart with the four columns. I asked him to write down each of the triggers, the emotional triggers that would set him off in this situation, the nuances, the things that, what did I call him, Tom, the things that Tom would say that would trigger him and what his usual behavior or usual response was. Because in going from the first column to the second column, that's the state change. And that would be instantaneous, and he would be in a reactive state to respond in a way that was not productive for him. And then we focused on developing a mantra, on getting centered and grounded. We're going to go over that and how to do that in a minute. But to really get grounded and centered. And then while he's not in that boardroom with Tom, to create what he would like as an ideal response to that trigger. So he did this for each of the triggers and went all the way across to create his ideal responses. So with this kind of chart in mind, these are the principles we discussed in applying it. First, not take it personally. To know that everyone is always making self-statements. That Tom was showing Jim exactly what it was like to be him. When I asked Jim how he understood Tom responding in the way that he did, Jim could reflect, he probably feels threatened or insecure at the times he gets on his soapbox and lectures. Jim recognized he was taking personally the behavior that was really Tom's counter to his own discomfort. And this is something that we often do in coaching, is to help someone develop more social and emotional intelligence. And this is something particularly in executive coaching. Proactively recognize emotional triggers and response patterns in order to get an ideal response in place. In other words, the first two columns are to cue his radar to be more aware more quickly of the usual triggers and the usual reaction or response to that so that he can recognize them instantly, even preempt them to create a centered, grounded state in order to respond ideally. So this helped him rein in natural emotional response. My recommendation also to Jim was to take notes while Tom was talking, because this chart is taking some repetition. It takes 30 days or so to develop a new neural pathway and neuronal connection. So he wasn't there yet, and he had to be negotiating on a daily basis. So I recommended to him that he take notes while Tom was talking. It literally kept him from verbally reacting, and he could plan what he wanted to say. He could write it out. He could then review what he would say to make it objective and reasoned. In other words, to restore left brain logic, right and left brain balanced reasoning and experience. Finally, he could make his points or statement when Tom finished speaking. So when Jim stayed in this balance, he did great. His regulation of his state of mind allowed him to sustain effectiveness rather than being emotionally derailed. His conclusion, I think, and this was way after this process, I think in looking back, I understand people like Tom and me better. I've had an easier time of it when I encounter people like him in situations like this. Now, let's look at this more specifically. To begin with looking at access to different states of mind, the regulation of feelings and states of mind involved the understanding and mastery to access to a particular state of mind without changing consciousness. In other words, staying present. Let me give you some examples. Probably nowhere is this more poignant than the regulation of state of mind than with artists and writers to enter a creative state. Dame Ida Sitwell would lie in the stale solitude of an open coffin as a prelude to enter the genre of mind to write her macabre literature. Voltaire used his lover's back for a writing desk. Benjamin Franklin, and one of my favorite nonfiction writers, Diane Ackerman, would write with a pine plank across a bathtub while they were soaking in warm suds to really create free association, basically. The painter Turner liked to be lashed to the mast of a ship and taken for sail during an incredible storm so he could later recreate the experience on canvas. Some authors play a particular piece of music repetitively during the course of writing to create an emotional framework to house their evolving story. The corresponding state of mind of the reader then matches with that of the author, because the author guides the reader to a particular state through the senses, the music and voice of the words, the texture of imagery, the rhythm of feelings. Now, we're going to talk about way more practical ways to do this as a coach than getting in a bathtub or going out in the storm, because you guys are not going to have that kind of time to do that. The most natural method of regulating states of mind is distraction, such as jangling car keys to shift a crying infant to a calmer state. We each have various ways that we reconnect mind and body, like getting grounded in physical activity, a walk in the outdoors, a warm bath, or breathing exercise. Now, we're going to discuss how you can do this with clients in a few moments. I want to provide a mentoring application here. It's important for the mentor coach to enter into and hold the mind-body state of the client to understand their subjective experience as well as the story that's communicated. Now, developmentally, the right brain communicates emotionally before the verbal abilities of the left brain mature. Most of the interactions in a relationship are outside conscious awareness in a right-brain-to-right-brain communication of emotional states of coach and client. And you get intuitive blinks that way. In fact, some recent research has shown that when two people are empathically connected with each other, and this occurs over the phone at least as well as it does in person, that their brain waves are in synchrony. It's like a musical symphony where there's a synchrony of the brain waves. As soon as one stops listening or there's a rupture of that empathic connection, it immediately stops. The mentor needs to remain open to receiving communication from the client, to be attuned to the state of mind of the client. This precedes any kind of synthesizing and planning that we usually think of in coaching. Once we're attuned to the client, we can receive and resonate with communication in all forms, not just verbal. Together, we can then explore experiences, possibilities, brainstorm, and plan. This resonance can also creatively transform the experience into new ideas, co-creations, beyond where either might go alone. So we need to allow this kind of engagement with the client to take in emotional communication, to hold unexplained feelings, experiences, and ideas until a recognizable pattern emerges. This requires deep listening and attention simultaneously at multiple levels. It's a way of thinking and a way of experiencing combined. It's the art and science of mentor coaching. Now, an everyday application here to recognize and understand emotional couplings. Regardless of how logical we think we are, our first register of a new stimulus is emotional. Neuroscientists have demonstrated unequivocally any new input that we have goes directly to the amygdala in the midbrain and then to the hippocampus that attaches meaning. This is really the seat of the unconscious where meaning is attached. Then it goes to the forebrain to process consciously and intellectually. In other words, to have it light on something that makes logical sense. So, the emotional activation registers before cognitive areas of the brain come into play to assess options. In fact, neuroscientists have demonstrated that we make decisions, especially purchase decisions, and this is from a couple of neuroeconomics labs, that we make purchase decisions up to 10 seconds before we're even consciously aware of it. Once we unconsciously make an emotional commitment to a yes or to a no, then we move it to the forebrain to gather all kind of logical reasons to support the decision. And this makes for a confirmation bias. And this is why we buy emotionally and justify rationally. Once we make a choice, we couple memory and wisdom from past experiences with the best guesses of a likely future. Now, a part of the brain that anticipates pleasant outcomes, the pleasure center, the nucleus accumbens, activates a buy decision. Even the anticipation of a purchase triggers this and the release of dopamine. A don't buy decision originates in the insula, the area involved in anticipating pain. It's the area that gets activated when we actually pay for something. So this kind of organization can actually influence how we make decisions. Consider how credit cards decouple the buy the activation of the pain center in the brain. The pleasure of the purchase is segmented from the pain of the future payment. And this may be why people purchase 23% more on average when they use a credit card as they do with cash or check. It's hard to resist the immediate pleasure of buying, this kick-in of dopamine from the pleasure center. It's difficult to substitute a theory like a future need, long-term saving, or retirement for the immediate pleasure. Now, let's look at how to regulate states of mind. Let's get really practical here. The most important thing we can do, as I mentioned, to achieve success is to manage our emotions and regulate our state of mind, because everything else follows. What do these people have in mind, have in common? John Belushi, Marilyn Monroe, Elvis Presley, Janis Joplin, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Kurt Cobain. They never learned the critical success strategy of managing their states of mind. Using drugs, alcohol, or some other addictive substance or process to regulate a state of mind and manage emotions leads to significant compromise. Your state of mind, the particular software program you use, determines the meaning you attach to any stimulus. The meaning you attach then determines your behavior. And this is crucial. We talked about any stimulus comes in and goes immediately to the amygdala, which processes it, moves it to the hippocampus that attaches meaning and significance. So whatever meaning you attach to something is determined by the state of mind you're in. And the meaning that you attach determines your behavior. Think about how you might be very relaxed and enjoying a discussion with somebody and you hear a sound outside. You probably don't even notice it. You're by yourself and you're a little more vigilant and it's dark, you hear a sound, you get into alert. How you frame that, the state of mind you're in, determines the meaning you attach. Now, there are two primary ways to regulate our states of mind: physiology and focus. Physiology is how you use your body, your biochemistry, to change your state of mind. Relaxation, deep breathing, meditation. And the second is focus, what and how you focus on. From quantum physics and brain science, what you focus on is what you get. Not what you want, but what you focus on. Focus aligns your energy field. What you focus on, what you pay attention to, determines your state of mind. And again, your state of mind determines the meaning that you attach, and the meaning you attach determines your behavior. So your power is in your focus. The questions we ask determine what we focus on. A couple of questions we're always asking. What does this mean? What should I do? If you have an habitual feeling that you don't like, it can come from a repeated focus and questions. Why does this always happen to me? Why am I overweight? The focus in both of these instances is in something negative. The quality of your life comes down to the quality of the questions you ask daily. Change the questions. Ask a better question. We're always asking questions from the moment we wake up, although we're not always aware of asking them. I've done this with a couple of clients who were in a situation, particularly at their companies, where there was some significant turmoil and significant distress, and they would wake up as the first thing they would think of. Now, what we do, what all of us do every morning before we're even consciously aware of it, is we're asking ourselves questions. You know, what's going to happen today? What can go wrong today? Or can I really do this? So what I asked each of them to do was to write, the evening before, to write three empowering questions. Questions that, answering those questions would put them in a peak state, a state that would be a very positive state of mind. Set those questions down, and the first thing in the morning, as they turned on their bedside lamp, before they ever really woke up, to take those questions and to answer them. And it put them in a positive state of mind and was the most significant thing of anything that we did at that time period in the work of coaching. So ask a better question. Ask an empowering question. What will I create today that will be more powerful than I've dreamed of? What will I create today that will be fun and empowering for me? Your brain follows your focus, whether that's positive or negative. So ask questions habitually that empower you. Not a negative focus like why am I overweight, but what can I do today for better nutrition and enhanced physical shape? Asking effective questions determines your state of mind. This is your power of focus. Ask habitual questions that empower you. The best mentors, leaders, and teachers are the ones who ask the best questions to get us to use our own resources. People thought Goliath was too big to hit. David asked, if he's that big, how could I miss? Starbucks founder Howard Schultz didn't ask if people wanted to buy a cup of coffee or a latte, but do you want a concept of community, a third place between home and work? Listen to how Steve Jobs convinced Pepsi president, at that time John Sculley, to become CEO at Apple. They were on a balcony overlooking Central Park in New York City, and Jobs simply asked Sculley, do you want to sell sugared water all your life, or do you want to change the world? So here's an exercise. Write down three questions that put you in a peak state. Each morning, answer those three questions, those empowering questions, and feel the answer. Remember, you're already asking questions. You just change the focus to consciously engineer those questions that empower you. Now, let's look more closely at this third column, at how to regulate state of how to get grounded and centered. Let's talk about mantras. When Southern Utah University's new basketball coach Robert Reed arrived, his team ranked 217th in free throw percentage out of 217 in their division nationwide. During practice, Reed had his players develop a mantra before each free shot. It was a cue, which he suggested be a dribble twice, a three or four word phrase, and he suggested something like relaxed and smooth, but emphasized that each player developed their own phrase, so it would be really uniquely theirs, coupled with a deep breath for relaxation, breathing in deeply, breathing in relaxation, and breathing out any tension. Additionally, so we're looking at a three-part mantra, a cue, like dribbling, a deep breath while you're saying a phrase. And this takes really 3 or 4 seconds. Additionally, he simulated game conditions by abruptly stopping a player in practice and asking him to shoot 2 free throws, because this really is about regulation, because you don't get to, in a real game, you don't get to line up and shoot 30 free throws and count the best ones. You're often fouled, and you're on tilt because you're fouled, and you have all the crowd response, either at home and away or away another way. So there's a lot of simulation. So he simulated this mindset of pressure in a game by asking them to stop and shoot 2 free throws. If they made the 2 shots, they got to take a breather. If they missed either one, he had them sprint around the court. In 2 years, the team was ranked number 1 in their division nationwide. So again, 3 parts to a mantra, a cue, 2 dribbles, or some personal gesture, a phrase, and then a deep breath, breathing in relaxation, breathing out tension. Before I do any keynote, I have a little cue, because I don't usually carry a basketball, I put my index finger and my thumb together on both hands, making 2 little circles, and I touch them in the middle, making a little infinity sign while I'm breathing in 1 deep breath of relaxation, breathing out any tension, and stating the phrase, relaxed and powerful. And in 3 or 4 seconds, I'm good to go. I'm in a peak state to do that presentation. Mantras can be used in various situations to regulate states of mind, especially for emotional triggers that can instantly change a state of mind. Some of my clients are pro athletes and actors. They use it to get grounded and centered for their performance. And pro athletes are very conscious of managing states, and so are actors, because they have to get in character. And they know that getting in a state will determine their success because the access to everything they need is in that state, like a software program on the computer. So mantras can both calm as well as keeping you from overthinking in a high-pressure situation and put you at peak performance. Now, I want to talk about neural conditioning. And that's really the overview of this chart. You'll see the title is Neural Conditioning to Make Changes That Last. What we associate to a stimulus determines our behavior, as I've mentioned repeatedly before. To change your behavior, change your neural association. Now, thinking positively is just simply not enough. You can think positively for a moment, but then you go back to whatever's already been established in your brain, the default mode, in the neural networks and connections. It would be the same effect as trying to change a software program on your computer by booting it up and talking positively to your computer. In fact, one of the philosophers of the 21st century said, everybody has a plan till he gets punched in the mouth. And that was Mike Tyson. I didn't say one of the great philosophers. I said one of the philosophers. The stimulus response is there in your brain, even if you don't believe it or know it's there. It's there in your hippocampus. It's linked. Winston tastes good. What's your association? For 80% of people, it's like a cigarette should. Even if you don't smoke, even if you have a strong belief linking smoking and cancer, even if it's been 30 years since you last heard that, what you link inside your head, the meaning you give, determines your behavior. You can change your behavior when you change the meaning. You can reprogram your associations and rewire your brain. Reprogramming, neural conditioning, is a process, and it's not an event. You can't work out one time and be healthy for life. A neural association gets linked or anchored by the coupling of strong emotion to whatever's happening around you at the time. Or it gets linked by the early downloads of programs early on in life. Neuroscientists estimate that about 90 to 95% of our operating systems are unconscious. And much of that comes from the programs, the downloads that we've had in interacting with other important people in our lives. Now, here are ways to think about changing behavior that seems very persistent with someone. There are two forces, if you think about it, behind all behavior. And this is one of the ways I like to get really simple and look at the elements of understanding how someone constructs their story and how to construct a new one, to deconstruct their present story and to reconstruct a new one. So the two forces behind all behavior, the need to avoid pain and the desire to gain pleasure. To understand the motivating forces of pain and pleasure, the need to avoid pain is biological. The brain fights against change to avoid pain on a biological basis. So trying to create success by creating more pain usually doesn't work. And the brain has the mechanisms that the things that we do automatically, the brain wires neuronal networks and connections to do those automatically to save energy. So at any moment, the pleasure of eating, for example, may feel greater than the pain of overweight, because that's an abstraction. The pleasure of the cheesecake is more enjoyable than the pain of the idea of being overweight, especially if it has strawberry topping. Overweight is an abstract idea, not at the same level of sensory reality as an immediate pleasure. Spending money in this moment is a greater pleasure than the later gain by saving or the later pain of avoiding debt financially and emotionally. So, to change your behavior, you have to change what you link to pleasure and what you link to pain. The need to avoid pain is usually greater than the need for pleasure. This drives much of human behavior, and it accounts for a bias that we have to avoid pain. To create loss is usually twice as painful as the pain as the pleasure of the gain. Somebody losing $100 will create twice as much pain as the pleasure of gaining $100. So to influence someone, find out what they're already influenced by, what they link pain and pleasure to. And here's a practical application. If you're not doing something that you want or need to do, probably link more pain with doing it than not doing it. Now, this is not going to make logical sense in the beginning. Let's look at something that really doesn't make logical sense. You want to make more money, but you're not doing it. You're procrastinating, or you're doing things that result in not making the money that you want. Somewhere in your unconscious mind, you link greater pain to having or making the money. With a lack of abundance financially, unconsciously, you may think that that money equals pain. So your surface story is, I want to generate more money and create wealth. The shadow story, though, is going in the opposite direction. And this is some of the ways that the shadow story can sound, not consciously. All this effort it would take, and I kind of think I'm just as comfortable with where I am, or I'd have to take advantage of people. I don't think I really know exactly what to do, or I'd be lonely at the top, all alone, or it would take too much time away from my family. People will judge me, and I'll be ostracized. If you're sabotaging success or not achieving the success that you want in any area of your life, look at the approach, wanting pleasure, and the avoidance, having fear. Now, the usual focus is, what will be the pain if I do this? The need for focus is this, what will be the pain if you don't follow through? What will be the cost in the pain if you don't do it? We are defined by the stories we tell ourselves. Is your story empowering you, or is it causing you to fall short? Is your story a limiting story in any area of your life? Which one is true? The one you pick will be the one that you believe and live. Most people are stuck because of the story they tell themselves. And sometimes that's the shadow story. The one that came from 10 years ago, or the one they want to believe. Your story contains the patterns that shape your behavior. Now think about it for a minute. What's the biggest addiction that we have as people? The thing almost impossible to give up or to abstain from. The pattern sequence that gives us an effective focus and actually allows us to escape our own fear. The biggest problem we have, the biggest addiction we have is our problems. For any situation, there are three components. And this is directly answering one of the questions that I received. State, story, and strategy. Now, as coaches, we usually begin with strategy and look at the story. Always begin with state. That's the most important thing because state determines the meaning you attach to something. State management is the most important aspect to choose the mindset that matches a successful outcome, the correct paradigm, the correct map. Strategy is to move beliefs to behavior for successful performance. Most people start with strategy, but strategy is an evolved part of the process. Reevaluation of your approach, your state of mind, is a first and key element. Story is the organizer of what we do, the theme and the storylines of what we're pursuing. So we have to recognize, own, assess, and decide what to change about the story, but it has to be within a state of mind that really fits. So, to a practical question here, how do you condition yourself to make changes that last? There are three key elements of neural conditioning to create change and to make it last. First, this is in your outline, identify what to change. You have to get to the point where you feel you must change now, and that you can change, must, can, and will change. And to feel that not changing would ultimately be more painful than the immediate pain of the change process. Believe that change will ultimately bring pleasure. Change can be linked with ultimate pleasure. So here are a couple of questions for this step. If you don't change your pattern, what will be the consequences? What is the pain associated to this current choice? And what will be the pleasure with changing? 2, interrupt the existing pattern. The most common mistake people make in coaching, after not first addressing once already existing. Doesn't work that way. Recognize the cues for the behavior so you can interrupt it immediately. You have to interrupt a pattern that isn't working, then substitute one that does. A pattern must be interrupted to change neural conditioning and create a different mindset. So a couple of questions for this step. What are the cues or the triggers for your pattern? The first column here, the emotional triggers. Think of ways to interrupt the pattern once you've identified it. And I would say, what is the second question really should be, what is the usual behavior with that cue or that trigger, and then how can you develop a mantra? Stick with that chart and go all the way across. Three, create a new association that empowers you. Think of all the things you gain and the pleasure you'll have with the change. Condition a new empowering association to the same cue. For example, if you're phobic about something, link feeling strong and powerful with the previous phobic stimulus. When you feel and behave differently, the problem dissolves by creating a new story. When you create a new story to be in, it's kind of like your lap when you get up and walk. It kind of disappears. You have to have a new story to be in before you can give up the old story. So a couple of questions for this step. What's the new association to the familiar cue or trigger? What's the change you want to bring about? And think of all the things you gain and the pleasures specifically that you'll have with this change. Here's a brief story, an example. Viktor Frankl wrote a book called Man's Search for Meaning about his experiences in a Nazi concentration camp during World War II. Many of you are familiar with this. He was a Jewish psychiatrist in a concentration camp where death was certain. Instead of just giving up and accepting his inevitable fate of death, he observed that about one of 25 of his fellow prisoners somehow managed to survive. He set about studying the characteristics of those who survived. He found that it was what the survivors associated to that made the difference to help them survive. 24 out of every 25 focused on the instant death that was inevitable, on their fate, and getting ready for death. The people who survived developed a reason to live, a why, to create a meaning for their suffering, to reframe it, in other words, rather than accepting their fate and wondering why God was allowing them to die. For example, they constructed a reason for surviving so that they could tell their story to their children, to make certain that this kind of suffering would never happen again. It changed the meaning of their suffering to something that would make a difference, to substitute an ultimate pleasure of purpose to transcend the immediate pain of their suffering. They were able to make it through and had a will to live that helped pull them through the toughest of times. Now, I want to give a couple of examples because I want to save some time for discussion. A couple of examples about application of state of mind. And I think a couple of good examples are self-control and self-regulation. They both play a role in success strategy. Self-control is simply a conscious, willful intention, and it's a tangible, short-term goal. Get hold of yourself, push through fatigue, count to 10, I'll go jogging this afternoon instead of stopping for a beer. These are established, as you know, with a client by establishing intention and setting an immediate, specific, concrete goal, and focus on a short time range for the specific response, a next step. Now, self-regulation is creating an optimum state of mind in order to access all the information in each of our different states of mind. In a particular state of mind, we have access to only that information. It's again, analogous to a software program. In WordPerfect, you can only access the information that's in WordPerfect. You can't access the information in Quicken when you're in WordPerfect. You have to go back to the search engine and move to a different software program. Same way with getting grounded and centered. When you are grounded and centered, you have access to all of your states of mind, all of the information that's in all of them, in your ultimate position of greatest synthesis and integration and creativity. Let me give you an example of an application with a client here. My client was a moderately successful CPA with attention deficit challenges. He functioned brilliantly when he was focused and became immersed in a specific task. But his challenge was twofold. if there were any external distractions, he got derailed and he had trouble moving from back to his task and moving from task to task, from project to project through the day with a kind of continuity. And his goal when we first started working together was he wanted to work more effectively and he wanted to affect a plan to move his local CPA firm to a regional, ultimately to a national firm. For him, self-regulation involved getting him to establish a weekly, then a daily schedule so that he had a map for the day and he could readily look at where he was. I worked with a number of coaches with ADD and have an analogous approach. I suggested he keep his daily schedule on a post-it on the left of his computer screen. So he created a week structure and then a daily structure hour by hour. He worked with an iMac, a big screen and a big wide margin on the left and right. And he put a post-it note of his daily schedule on the left, and I suggested that he put a post-it note on the right of his next hour's work, an NBA. Yeah, I knew he was an NBA fan, as I am. And his next best action. And the next hour, he put exactly the detail of what he was going to do that hour, and then each hour, he would put a new post-it note. So for his daily schedule, he learned to schedule blocks of uninterrupted time to sustain a state of mind. He precluded interruptions by turning off the telephone and ringer and to schedule any interruption so that he could be in one state of mind that fit a task. When he met with some of his partners, that was scheduled for a particular time where he did all of that at one time. All of his telephone calls were scheduled for one time. His immersion in work protected that time, no interruptions, no telephone, nobody knocked on the door, and he could be immersed, and he would write out the task of his day in one-hour blocks so he could maintain and sustain a state of time. And he would cluster, for example, the activities that required the same state of mind, like errands or the meetings. And he became amazingly successful and developed, by the time we were done, within a few months, a regional presence with his firm. So we have to take into account also what stimulates and motivates us in the formulation of goals, as well as listening to our biorhythms. In Texas, I'm in Houston. In Texas, that would be that would sound something like, it's easier to ride a horse in the direction it's going. So we have to take into account things like fatigue, sleep deprivation, energy level, attention, emotion, all of which affect state of mind and therefore access to optimum mental functioning. Now, additional influences, exercise, caffeine, alcohol, a whole number of things that fit into an overall picture of well-being. Now, let me mention one other example. Because I want to save some time for discussion. The management of state-specific issues like chokes and slumps and blocks. So a switch to an explicit memory, a conscious focus, can cause somebody to choke because choke is about losing instinct. Thinking too much reverts instinct to cognitive observer, creating a choke. But think about it when you play golf or engage in a sport. If you think about it, you're going to get out of your flow. You're going to get out of the body memory. Thinking about it moves away from the implicit, the automatic, to the intellectual, the explicit. This slight shift can disrupt that automatic procedural memory. And reverting to an explicit mode, thinking about it, makes it deliberate and considered, like when one first was taught to hit the ball or do the routine. So continuing this explicit mode can create a slump. Now, an example of a block. A panic or anxiety can narrow perception, focusing on one thing, analogous to thinking too little. Panic is about reverting to instinct. A block is about not being able to enter a creative state of mind. Nathan was a well-known nonfiction writer, just off a New York Times bestseller, when we began working together. You'd think that was a goofy time to start working with a coach. But he was experiencing a writer's block. He had not produced anything for a few weeks when he first called. I ask him to explain his writing process, to walk me through it step by step, frame by frame, in order to describe what he did and what he was experiencing. I wanted to hear his internal conversation with himself, frame by frame. He described how, as he sat down to write, he said, I get kind of nervous, and I began doing a lot of different things other than writing. Then I start wondering if I can produce another bestseller or if it was just a one-time happening. So he told me, in essence, exactly what we would work on in coaching. After exploring the details of this process and his distraction, I could observe, it sounds like you get really excited, maybe more so than ever, about immersing yourself in the passion that you've always wanted to experience. Well, he confirmed this. He said, yeah, it is an excitement. And I said, but you read that excitement as anxiety. It puts you in your old story where anxiety equals danger. And instantly, with the cue of that feeling, you're in a different state and you're stuck. And as we talked about that, he recognized how in his earlier story, distracting himself was adaptive. It was a way of regulating the tension. But when he used that trigger now, and in an old way, when he used the anxiety as a signal of something bad's about to happen, better head for cover, then he moved back to an old state. Think about how every client you work with engages in this process. At some point, when they engage in change, when you help them, and you're an expert at change to be a coach, you engage in choice architecture with every client. When they began to do something in a different way because you perturbated their system, you've looked at something or some way to do something different, they will inevitably feel an uncertainty and an anxiety about being in new territory. Literally, this is what happens in the brain. They've moved from the superhighway of the familiar, the neuronal pathways and networks, the highways and villages in the brain they're very familiar with. Even though it's not going exactly where they want, it's very easy travel because they're familiar with it. They know what the outcome is. And they're trying something new. They move from that superhighway to an overgrown trail with a machete, and they're making a new trail, so they're going to feel uncomfortable and anxious. So this is where you began working with them in helping them shape a new story by helping them understand that I understand the uncertainty and the trepidation because of trying something new. Every beginning happens in this way because you're not sure of the outcome. So what you're doing is helping them reframe this experience in a new way and looking at it as not a signal in the old story where danger equals, where anxiety equals danger, better head back for cover, but to reframe it as anxiety, trepidation, uncertainty is a signpost of progress, validation that you're moving ahead. So you're helping someone change their identity, the model that they operate on. And this is what I want to emphasize in this, that the most pervasive force of the human psyche is our identity and our desire and inclination to return to our identity. So if you don't help someone evolve the model that they operate on to understand and frame the new experiences in a new story, they'll revert back to where they were before. So with Nathan, let me conclude here because I want us to have some time to talk. This perception, this coupling of meaning and coping mechanism were part of his old story that he had now juxtaposed instantly with his state change onto his new evolving story. He recognized his current anxiety as feeling different, an excitement, while also an uncertainty about letting go of the familiar so he could stay with this longer and stronger. He reframed his excitement as validation of being in a new experience and as a signpost of progress to continue moving ahead in his writing. The result was he produced an even bigger bestseller. So I'm going to take us off of lecture mode and welcome your questions, comments, and discussion. And remember to manage the background noise with mute *6 until you're ready to talk. So we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested in your thoughts and your input. What do you think about this whole notion? Does this make sense to you, first of all?
This is Carl. I really appreciate the discussion today. It was fantastic. What would you recommend for people who might feel that there's a lot of expertise that you were sharing here and maybe we're not qualified to get to this level of psychiatric manipulation or whatever? I mean,
no, wait. Let me interrupt you now because this is focusing on the present moment. This is exactly what we do as coaches. I stopped practicing psychiatry and psychoanalysis 11 years ago, and I've been doing only executive mentor coaching for 10 years, and I'm very clear about what isn't and what is. And I present this to you because I think it can be one of the most powerful tools you have as a coach. You're not doing therapy or counseling. You're focusing on how someone can write the most effective story they possibly can in this moment, and you're helping someone with conscious choice architecture and the choices they make moment by moment.
So this isn't too complicated to start using with our clients today just based on the introduction you've given us?
Absolutely not. And you're welcome to use that neural conditioning chart to see if it's useful. I developed that chart with someone who, it was a woman executive who was very high functioning, you know, had a terrific career, but every time she went home to her family on major holidays, she could tolerate it for about a day, maybe a day and a half. It was, then she would lose it, and she said, "Dave, I've just got to figure out a way that I can stay for the whole time." And her goal was for 3 days without losing it. So if we construct it, I constructed this chart for her to look at the usual triggers and to look at I suggested that she's schedule like 30 minutes without interruption, like she would an appointment with a doc. Schedule an appointment with herself to write down all the emotional triggers and the usual responses, the first two columns, not by getting in that state, but being aware of it, and including like the little nuanced looks from her mother, the way that her dad would say something, the way that somebody would, just all of those and their usual response. And then we worked on a mantra that was effective for her, and she would then, in a different time period, look at her ideal responses and craft that and use this. And she had a successful first weekend. She had one little backslide, but got quickly back and was able to use it effectively. So I think this can work very well. I think each of you can use it, which is why I'm presenting it to you. I'm telling you everything I can possibly tell you in 50 minutes and hope that it will be of benefit to you. Now, I interrupted you twice. I'll tell you about my rule of engagement with clients in a moment, but would you finish your question, and I'll try to restrain myself.
No, that's exactly what I was asking, David. Thank you.
Okay, absolutely. Good. Good. One of the questions, common ways you see coaches miss the mark, to not put state first before strategy and story. Another question is it about state of mind for the coach or for the client? It's both. You set the tone. You are the guide. You set the tone. And creating a state of mind in which you are centered and grounded and feel confident, then it's going to be the best thing you can possibly do for your client. Because the best thing we can possibly give to our client is the model of how to operate and the belief in that client, then they're going to teach us why. Because while you're talking about all kinds of things, they're going to be downloading the model that you provide, the model of how and who you are, the model of how you regulate, the model of how comfortable you are setting and collecting professional fees, the whole gamut. That model is the best hope they have of a very different success in the future. And another question, what's your most important insight about coaching? It's from my favorite grandmother who said, if you are not having fun, you're not doing it right. that's my best shot at that question. We have maybe another minute or so. I want to respect our time. Any other questions or comments?
Hi, this is Monica. I have one quick question.
Thanks. Go ahead.
It seems like the most challenging piece in what you've described that I would think would be the moment at which you hit that trigger point, you recognize it as a trigger, and what I understood you to say is that you want to change it to be a positive stimulus rather than a trigger toward the negative?
Yes. That really is, that's something you can do directly, but it's also a result of working this chart. If you pick any emotional trigger and the usual reaction or behavior, and I focus on behavior, not meaning, not why, I don't go back into the past, look at feelings and causes and all that kind of stuff, but to look at how somebody responds. Now, I think it's important to connect with somebody to empathically resonate with their experience. That puts you on common ground. Then you can look at what's next. That's the state. Then you can look at strategy and story. So, back to the chart. If when someone identifies a trigger and their usual response, they're going to be able to recognize it sooner, be able to revert to an ideal response quicker. When they have a mantra, a way of regulating state of mind, and an ideal behavior or response, that's what they want to replace it with. And in the beginning, it's going to take work on this. They're going to have to consciously go through each of these steps. But ultimately, when you do something and repeat a behavior, the brain rewires. So ultimately, this is going to create a new connection. You create a different meaning for that emotional trigger. You know, for example, my executive woman who I developed this, she was able to look at her mom's rolling her eyes in a particular way that would just set her off, and she was off to the races. You know, she would just say, that's how mom is. Or somebody you're engaged, let me tell you just a brief story, and I know I'm over time, but let me tell you a brief story. I was on a board of directors, and one of the members, an older member that was very opinionated, had a very strong and heated opinion about a certain matter. And as he was expressing his opinion, he got up and circled the entire conference table. And as he got louder and louder, he was doing it. And as he sat back, he slammed both fists on the table and said, "This is what we have to do." And the very wise chairperson said, "That is a point of view. Now, let's hear some others." So you can associate different meanings, but it's going to take time for your brain to rewire. Your brain will rewire. And that's one of the miracles of coaching. When you help someone revise their mind software and rewire their brains, which is exactly what this neural conditioning is. This is rewiring your brain at a midbrain level. When you do this enough, somebody is going to use that trigger to get to a totally different place, not artificially substituting some goofy meaning that has some particular usefulness, but really working at it. This is the work you do, the hard work miracle in coaching. I really appreciate all of you and your attention, your energy. Thanks for allowing me to be here. I hope this has been helpful. It's been a privilege for me to present to you, and I hope our paths cross again.